this little statement to read. The Department of Religious Studies at the University of Kansas is conducting a research project that seeks to preserve the history of religious experience in Kansas. We would like to record your memories of your experiences with religion and or religious organizations. We expect that each interview will take about 1 hour. We assume that you are not obligated to participate and may discontinue your involvement at any time. Since we are trying to create a public record of Kansas religious history, we are primarily interviewing persons who agree to let their interviews be available to the general public through a website and to be identified by name as the person who was interviewed. Should you have any questions about the project, please contact Professor Tim Miller at 785-864-7263 or tkansas@ku.edu. If you have any questions about your rights as a research participant, you may call the Human Subjects Protection Office at 785-864-7429 or email mdenning@ku.edu.
All right.
Please state your name and tribal affiliation.
Yeah, it's Ed Smith and Osage Nation.
So I know we had talked a little bit about this before, but what is the traditional territory of the Osage Nation?
It depends on the time that you're talking about, because they say that we came from down the Ohio River Valley from like the Virginias a long time ago. Kind of settled in the Mississippi River Valley for a few hundred years near St. Louis. And then most recently, the area that's predominantly south of the Missouri River, north of the Arkansas River, east of the Mississippi, and west of the Rockies.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
And how was contact with Europeans? How did that affect the territory?
For a lot of years, things were fine. Our first contact with Europeans that was recorded, there's some debate, but recorded-wise was 1673 with Marquette and Joliet. They traveled down the Illinois River and met a group of us somewhere along the Mississippi when they were coming down. And then, you know, we traded with the French quite a bit, and then later the English. Spanish as well, because we did take trips to trade with the Taos Pueblo people, and so we had contact with the Spanish that way. Some suggest maybe earlier with, there's an unknown group of Indian people that Coronado came in contact with when he was up this way, and they think they might have been Osages, but because they weren't named, they don't know.
And are those coming from European records of contact, or is that Osage? Okay.
Yeah. And so, but yeah, we had trade relationships, business relationships, basically, with those folks. Because we were along the river, major river routes, the Missouri River, things like that, we had a pretty strong influence on those trade relations with all the tribes that were west of what's today St. Louis, pretty early on. So we kind of developed a business sense that way with those European countries, and kind of kept some of the Western tribes at bay that way. And then with those trade relationships comes power, especially when you're talking about things like horses and guns. Mm-hmm. And so when you're talking about with your enemies and things like that, then yeah, we kept those, kept them from getting guns, kept them from getting horses for a time. So yeah.
How soon after contact, is there a record of when missionaries started coming to proselytize to Osage Nation?
Yeah. If I remember correctly, I think it was the Jesuits. Because actually, I think it was... Joliet was a missionary, but they weren't establishing missions amongst us then. But St. Louis was a heavily French area, so there would have been a lot of Catholics there. And that's actually who holds a lot of our records, even to this day, is the church in St. Louis, Catholic Church in St. Louis. For a period of time, we actually asked for missions to be established among us. Because when the Cherokees were moved in the 1800s, we saw how good they were being treated, what kind of preference they were being treated as being considered civilized. And so we asked for the establishment of missions, and some people argue that maybe it was more of a ruse to say, oh look, we're civilized, we have missions, because when those missions were built, then they were boarding schools, and a lot of people didn't send their kids to them, or they'd send them for a while and then take them back, or you know, want to take them here and there. And so there's also an argument that could be made that maybe they didn't understand all of that. But we would send kids to St. Louis to the schools there. And later on, a lot of Osages sent their kids to boarding schools, private boarding schools. So a lot of the abuses and things that happened to the government boarding schools and things like that, we didn't suffer as badly because we sent our kids to private, paid to send them to private boarding schools. So they were, conditions were different. They were treated a lot better. And there was even a St. Louis, called the St. Louis Boarding School there in Pawhuska, where our tribal seat is. Now there's just a historic site marker. There's nothing left of it, but it was right there on our reservation in Oklahoma. But now the sites that I was talking about before are in southwest Missouri and southeast Kansas. One of those sites is St. Paul, Kansas now.
Okay.
But it started out as the Osage Mission.
And what was the reasoning behind sending the children to the boarding schools? Is it religious, education?
Yeah, okay. Education. Education, and to have that kind of sense of the government. At the time, we were dealing with what they called the Osage-Cherokee Wars.
Mm-hmm.
The Cherokees were being pushed through the Trail of Tears this way, and we were having conflicts because it was our land. Even the land the Cherokees are on now was part of, was our traditional territory. Nobody asked us if they could be there. They just made Oklahoma Indian territory, and oh, we're going to put these people here. But that used to be part of Osage land, and a group of tribes known as Kedoan people that were some enemies of ours and some relatives of ours, the Quapaws and stuff. That was all their homelands that the Cherokees went to, and they had brought them through southern Missouri on that trail, one route of that trail, and so that was our territory. And so we had attacked them, and they retaliated, and you know, back and forth for quite a while. And of course, you know, if they attacked us, then we attacked them, then they knew how to play the game, and they went finger pointing and crying to the government, and oh, these Osages attacked us, you know, blah, 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 and knew how to play favorites, and they're like, oh, you know, we're civilized, you know, we wouldn't do that, we didn't do this stuff, and it was all this kind of two-faced type of stuff, and they were, you know, guilty of doing it too, but it was, they knew when to, it's kind of like, I think of it as like you're, you know, those times when you're, if you got a younger sibling and that younger sibling hits you, and when you hit them back, they go crying to mom and dad. That's how I thought about, that's how I kind of pictured it when I was a kid.
Okay.
And so, you know, they would go crying around and like, oh, these mean Osages. So that's when we asked for those missions, was to be like, oh no, look at us. We're asking for these missions. Nobody made us get them. Nobody did that. So, and then again, when they were established and going on and everything, then, you know, very few Osages actually sent their kids to them, so
mm-hmm.
I think that didn't last very long,
mm-hmm.
as far as a plan.
So how did the, what you just talked about with the relocation of the other tribes and then the Osages asking for missions, how did that affect Osage tribes' relationship with the federal government?
Well, even before that, it had gotten strained because William Clark, like from the Lewis and Clark expedition, became an Indian agent after that, and this was around the time where we had ceded between 1808 and 1825, I think it was. We had signed a whole bunch of treaties ceding all of our lands in Missouri. So they moved us to our lands in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to butt up. There was this strip of southern, like southeast Kansas. I can't remember how long it was. Something like 400 miles, like 50 miles north-south and 400 miles long, something like that. But it went all the way to Missouri. What was happening was these settlers were in Missouri where they should be, and then they were crossing that line. You know, to some respect, it's an imaginary line. You can't see it. You don't know where you're at, type of thing. But they kept coming over and coming over. And, of course, the Osages were, you need to get out of here. And then same thing like with the Cherokees. They go run into the cavalry. Oh, look, these guys kicked us out of off our land, blah, blah. And of course, U.S. law, being what it is going to take the side of the settlers and say, well, they've been living here 7 years. You know, now they own that because it's squatters' rights, right? You guys didn't notice that. And so they took a chunk of our reserve, and so the rest of the reservation was known as the Osage Diminished Reservation, and they made that a buffer zone, and they still said nobody can live here. And that's what established Fort Scott, Kansas. So Fort Scott was built to put an army down there in southeast Kansas to deal with not just the Osages, but any settlers trying to move into that area. we lived that way for a while, but that last treaty, you know, we'd never went to war with the United States. Sometimes we served as scouts for the Army when it suited us for other tribes. But we never went to war, and giving up our lands in Missouri and stuff, William Clark said that was one of the hardest treaties that he ever had to sign, because we didn't want to do it, and we were still kind of forced to do it. It was one of those, you know, pennies on the dollar type of things, and, oh, we'll give you food and stuff like that, and if you don't sign it, well, we're gonna, you know, make you do it. And so, because the Osages were the first group of Indians that him and Meriwether Lewis had met on their trip up the Missouri on that Corps of Discovery, they had met him in St. Louis. We were on our way to Washington, D.C. to talk to Thomas Jefferson. and so they didn't meet us on the trip, but they met us in the city. Mm-hmm. There was a delegation of chiefs headed to Washington. So we, you know, always had that relationship with the United States, or with France, or, you know, these entities of doing business and things. We were for a time major players in that game of the fur trade and things like that. There's a lot of, there's probably too much information out there on the Osage role of the fur trade and kind of that early founding of that part of the country, because I think there's a bunch of books about that and not a lot of books about anything that's happened much after. Mm. So, yeah.
How did the treaties and the army restricting the land that the Osages could be on, how did that affect Osage religious practice?
Certainly it probably, it had an effect of access to sacred sites. So there are some sites that, you know, we talk about to this day as being sacred, and some that we've kind of needed to be reminded that were holy places. Like, we don't do a lot of now we have these heritage trips, they call them, that we'll get a tour bus and take groups like 25 people, like around places we used to live, and we'll talk about these like springs that come out of the ground and how these were holy places and things like that. But I think for the most part, we don't talk about them like the Lakota people talk about the Black Hills or anything like that. But it's good to know, and there was like a lot of places that I grew up with as a kid around the St. Louis area that are really kind of sacred sites that I was never really taught that they were that way until recently, to just kind of reevaluate and relook at them and be like, this is a holy place. Like, why did we never told that explicitly, like that this was that way, and and so I'm not sure. But then there's medicinal plants that we lose access to, because things can change plant wise things change within 25 to 30 miles, so there's things we may not have access to, and things like that. But even within our history, we have this saying that talks about a move to a new country. It's a saying. It's not always an actual physical move. It's a social restructuring of the tribe. And so that's happened for us several times throughout our history, where we tell the story of we made a new move to a new country. Maybe we adopted another tribe into us and had to restructure to fit that or something of that that sort. And so it happens. We're not a static culture, never have been. But I don't know that, because some of that was still there, we don't talk about a major religious shift until we get to Oklahoma. Nothing real big happens till we move out of Kansas and get to Oklahoma.
And what was the process of moving from Kansas to Oklahoma? Was that
It was another forced move. They were trying to get all the Indians out of Kansas. And we were one of those. It was another kind of like leaving Missouri. It was forced, but it wasn't type of thing. It was through a treaty. They were going to make us leave anyway. But instead of giving us land in Oklahoma, we sold the government our reservation here. An outright sale. They didn't just take it and then give us some other piece of land. We sold it to them, put the money in account, and then we made a deal with the Cherokees and bought bought the land that we have now, plus a little more actually. And some parts of that we had gave away later to a couple other tribes that needed some land. But we sold that land, and then bought the rest. The land that we live on now, we actually paid for that. So,
what time period was that?
1872-73. So the way we kind of did it is we were semi-nomadic folks, and so a lot of times we can't have permanent villages, but we'd go on a buffalo hunt and then come back to our village. And so basically my understanding what we did that year is we went out on the buffalo hunt and then we went to the new place. Okay. And so it wasn't that far because we were on the southern border I mean, it was far if you were walking. But we're on the southern border of Kansas, Oklahoma, and our reservation's on the northern border of Kansas and Oklahoma. So it was just kind of went down from there.
And what religious changes happened after the move to Oklahoma?
There was some sicknesses that happened. We had a complex religious order that involved all our clans. And so a sickness came and took a lot of our people, including some of our clan leaders, and we weren't able to continue to practice that the way we did. And because of that, we decided to not do it anymore. Because we had not just lost people, but the knowledge that they had. And so for a while, we kind of, some people had already converted to Christianity. And then there was several movements going on back then. There was, some tribes were doing the sun dance, some tribes, the ghost dance was becoming popular. And so some people kind of checked out those things and we were all like, it's not for us. And then some of our relatives among the Quapaw were hosting a man named John Wilson, and he was a Caddo man that people called him Moonhead, and he was a a practitioner of this religion called the Native American Church. Mm-hmm. And he was among the Quapaw people, teaching them about this. And they had invited some of the Osages over to hear him talk, and went through ceremonies and stuff, and so they brought that back. And it took a while. Some families did it, some didn't like it, and it took a while, and it's kind of, but then the people started doing it. So nowadays, when we talk about our traditional religion, that's probably the closest thing to what we have, is that Native American church. Okay. There are parts of the old religion. Some will tell you that there's not, but because a lot of Native religions aren't, we don't have words for religion a lot of times, mm-hmm. and if we do, it's a word that we've kind of come up with to translate into a Western thought process, because stuff's so ingrained in our culture. There's some of our old ways that didn't get tossed out that are still part of our process and our thinking and stuff that are religious in that nature, but some people will tell you that that's not true. But for the most part, yeah, we put that those old things aside, to because we can't do them anymore and it's not safe and everything. And so we have that, those NAC, they call it, church ways. And then a lot of people are Christian. Catholicism's big. We have the only... I know we have the only church in America, might be the only church in the world, that actually has stained glass images of people that aren't saints in the, and they had to get permission from the Vatican to do that. There's actually Osages in the stained glass, not just the saints and stuff.
Where is that cool. located?
It's in Pawhuska. It's pretty awesome. There's pictures of it online, but yeah, that was pretty cool.
And you're talking about earlier when you were living in St. Louis and looking at, you know, different sites and realizing that at one point they must have been sacred sites, active sacred sites. Is that something that more people in the Osage tribe are thinking about nowadays, or is it?
Yeah, I think because of the heritage trips. I mean, because we talk, you know, we've taken several trips there now over the years. And so, I mean, like I said, there's usually about 20, 25 people go each time, and it tries to be different. And then they're going to different places too. So this past year they went to the, what we call the Four Corners. So it's like Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas. So they went to like some places around that area. And I think the year before they were just in Arkansas, maybe. And then I want to say next spring they're supposed to come up here to the Kansas City area. So I'm supposed to help with that trip, just coordinate, like, you know, restaurants and getting around. Mm-hmm. Help with that if I can, but
when did those trips start becoming a regular occurrence?
I'm bad with recent time.
Okay.
As I'm getting older, I want to say 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay.
Maybe. It's kind of a joint thing between the, because we have a historic preservation office with the tribe, most tribes do, and the
they'll deal with, you know, highway department accidentally comes across a burial or village site while they're putting in a new road or something, or you know, somebody's building a Walmart and they're digging the foundation and, oh, look, we found a body or an arrowhead or something, and they have to stop. It's a law.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of do a deal like that. And so, and then we have a culture center. And so those are kind of our culture keepers there. But, you know, the historic preservation people are too. They have to know that stuff. And you know, they're picking up pieces of things and have to know the story behind that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of like a joint thing with them. And when they go to each site, sometimes there's local folks there. Maybe they're a anthropologist at a local school or something that's done some research out there that'll share some information. And sometimes it's good information, and sometimes we're sitting back going, this person's goofy, or, you know, like, man, it's really cool that we got to come here, but this guy does not know what he's talking. Like, we know the cultural stuff, and we're going, oh my God, this guy, you know, this person doesn't know what they're talking about. I had that experience on the trip to St. Louis, because there was a person that I was just like, oh, this guy knows this place so good. He'd written all these books about it, and then he started talking, and I was like, really? Like, oh my God, this guy didn't know nothing. Like, here, I looked up to this person all this time, and now, no. Like, I'm not reading any more of their stuff anymore, because you're full of it. But yeah, happens sometimes.
Yeah. Do you ever bother correcting people, or is it good enough that you know?
No,
that
we're polite.
Okay.
It's not like an Indian thing to do to just correct somebody that way. So I say we're polite, and then we talk about them on the bus. But yeah, so yeah, just kind of one of those things that, yeah, we wouldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But because some of that's our information.
Mm-hmm.
That they don't need to know anyway. And it's not for public knowledge. And so, yeah, some of that stuff we just keep to ourselves too. So we know it, and that's all that needs to know it.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, it doesn't need to get published mm-hmm. in a book and stuff like that. So yeah.
And the bus trips, is that, you know, mostly like a youth movement, or is it you know, something that the older generations have established?
It's mixed. Well, as for who started it, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But there's mixed of groups. Tends to be a little bit older people, not like itty bitty kids or anything, because they're like a week long, and it's during school year, so
mm-hmm.
kids are in school. But yeah, there are some, you know, 20-year-old folks, and then there's some retirees. So there's a pretty good age range.
And would you say, generally speaking, that the youth are interested in Osage culture and practicing Osage culture?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
I also wanted to ask, because we were talking about sacred sites,
mm-hmm.
and I know, you know, a site can be considered sacred for various reasons. Could you talk about what makes a site sacred for you?
Yeah, I mean, there are various reasons. There's religious reasons, there's cultural reasons. You know, things can have cultural significance, and so they can be have kind of a deep meaning or a deep connection that way. And then there's like the kind of what you would consider the religious side of things that are important. You know, what was I like what I talked about earlier with like the Lakota people, you know, the Black Hills, they came out of those. So, you know, when I was talking with somebody the other day about, you know, I was like, we were talking about the Black Hills, and I was like, man, you know, I really, you know, we came from, talk about coming from like the Virginias and stuff, and but we came like out of the sky. And so it's like, you know, I wish we knew where that place was. And they were like, and it was the older guy, and he was like, yeah, that would be something, you know, if we could actually knew where came down to the earth and mm-hmm. something like that. And you know, you have, there's places where there's stories, and those, and you could say it's cultural or religious, where we have stories that are linked to certain areas, that there might be culture figures or, you know, things like that. So yeah, those things could be considered sacred or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Just like so caught up in you talking, I haven't thought of another question to ask you. Mm-hmm. So I guess we could talk about, again, with the, after being moved to Oklahoma, were Osage people still sending their children to boarding schools?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, still sending boarding schools. And then, like I said, we had that St. Louis boarding school that was on the reservation there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they still talk about sending them to St. Louis. And then the one there was named St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
Boarding schools, those were run by, oh gosh, what is it? It was a group of nuns, and they were out of St. Louis. Like the order of that order of nuns out of St. Louis. I'm trying to think of what their name is off the top of my head. I don't know, it might cross my mind a little bit, but
okay.
But yeah, and so and there were some that, you know, went to Haskell.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the first students at Haskell were Osage. So it's just a mix, you know, some went to government boarding schools, some went to private, just depended.
And how did that affect the teaching of culture and tradition to the younger generations that were going to these boarding schools?
Well, it definitely impacted a lot because they didn't get to come home.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things where we found ourselves with, in the 90s, with only 12 fluent speakers.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, we lost a bunch of that, and it wasn't just you know, some stayed home. It wasn't everybody sending their kids away, so we didn't have the huge problem that some tribes did, where you know, you don't just lose culture and language, you lose parenting skills because nobody brought you up.
Mm-hmm.
So who do you learn from? No one. So when you get older and have a child, you don't know how to raise it because
mm-hmm.
nobody raised you.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know how to show a child you care for it or anything because nobody showed you, had a cold upbringing
mm-hmm.
and things like that. And so yeah, that's stuff that affects a generation, because even when you do manage to raise your own kids, they grew up in a cold household. So
mm-hmm.
then somewhere along the lines, you've got to break that, you know, or if you do get lucky enough to where maybe if that parent comes back and maybe they're busy working and they need the grandparents to raise them, then at least the grandparents there to raise them right.
And the language. Mm-hmm. So has there been any sort of revitalization movement for it?
Yeah. Yeah, they declared a state of emergency. I think it was the 31st Congress, I think is who did it, declared a state of emergency, and they established a language program, started, you know, interviewing the people that still spoke. It was really scary too, because like right after they did that, like 6 of those 12 people died. And then, but now we have 3 districts on our reservation. All 3 districts have language programs, classes. They're teaching it in the public schools. Tribe pays for that. Then we have an immersion school. So they're working on their accreditation, and they take kids at 6 months so that when they're starting to develop their language skills, it's their first language. So they're not waiting until they're in kindergarten. They're mm-hmm. taking them that early. And so it's kind of wrapped up with Head Start and everything else. But then it's K through 3rd grade right now. And then my niece is in the top grade. And so each year they go up, they hire another teacher. So they just keep going with that. And the parents have to take language classes. And so because it's not enough to be immersed in language for 8 hours if you're not in at 16.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to talk to them, and they do culture classes and things like that so that they're not just learning the language, but they're learning the cultural stuff that goes along with it.
And is that something that a lot of people have been interested in doing?
Yes and no. It was really nice this last election cycle, because anybody that voiced opposition to that program did not get elected.
Really?
Yeah. So I would say that, yeah, that most people are for it. Only about half the tribe lives on or around the reservation, and so, because some people are like, oh, do we, you know, and it's always the ones that don't speak the language. You know, I've never heard anybody that speaks Osage say we don't need it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always the ones that aren't around there. So it's always people living outside or far away that are like, oh, this is costly. This is, you know, that don't understand the significance and the impact that this is going to have.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, but it can be a hot topic at meetings. Because
mm-hmm.
even a couple of people just mentioned, like, you know, hey, we're short on money. How much does this cost per student? And they were asking normal questions, I thought. You know, how much is it per student? And those are questions we ask here at the college and everywhere else. But man, as soon as they started asking those questions, people were like, oh, they lied. They're already attacking the school. No, that's, if you want a budget for the future, you need to know these things.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily, it's not an attack. And so, yeah. So.
Has there been a lot of either movements to preserve culture or to preserve language with Osages that do not live on or near the reservation?
Say it one more time.
That's just her. Like, you know, because Kansas City, I don't know how many Osage live here, but if there's like a large population in a certain area, do you know of any cultural or language revitalization movements in kind of, I guess, satellite communities?
Oh, no, no, it's mostly down there. Okay. Yeah, yeah, it's, there is online classes that we can do, and then now they have about little after this time last year, they've got the...
I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah. They have the app. And this is huge. This is huge, not just for those that don't live in the reservation, because I taught myself some basic Osage, but it took a long time just with the early materials, which is like a book and some tapes. But... this is a big deal for the future, for our kids. And there's even times where I'm like, somebody asks me a question and I'm like, oh, I don't know. And I can just go into this thing and look up a word, or if I'm having just a old man moment, I can go do that and remind myself of something, you know. So that's been helpful.
Is that something that your kids are also interested in?
I made them download it, yeah.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No.
No?